Content warning, discussions of torture and execution that some listeners might find upsetting. Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 9, Torture and Confession. This episode is dedicated to Margaret Brown. So today we're joined by David Silk. David is head of learning at Newcastle Castle and a historian and storyteller. And he's joining us again here on the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me back.
So in this episode, I thought we could talk about what happened to the witches when they were imprisoned and talk about any kind of torture that may have been involved. I think a lot of people associate witch trials with torture.
Yeah, very much.
And sadly also their eventual execution and where that was. So just to help our listeners kind of understand where we are in the story, 28 people have been found guilty of witchcraft, men and women, and they're taken to the Guildhall. Can we start there? Like, what's happening in the Guildhall?
Yeah, so the Guildhall, I think, is where the witch finder or witch pricker does his part in the trial. So he jabs them with pins to try and find the witch's mark,
yeah,
which is supposed to mark them out as being witches. Whether you want to call that a trial or mm-hmm. not, it's not probably a legally official trial at that stage, I don't think.
But there will eventually be a trial. But between the Guildhall, they're found guilty of witchcraft by the Witchfinder. Are they taken to jail in Newcastle and waiting for an official trial?
Yes, I think
trial?
That's basically the way it would work. So 1649, they will have been found to be witches. So yeah, in summer 1650 is probably about when the trial occurs. So the trials in this period are generally called assizes. They're the criminal trials. The judges for these trials are organised into circuits. So they work for the king, they work for the central authority, and they're kind of travelling judges, and they go around the country, and there's a northern circuit, which Newcastle's part of. So the judge, I think, is based out of York, and they move around the various northern counties, and throughout the year, they do what's called delivery of jail. So they deliver the prisoners from the jail, so bring them out of the prison, yeah, put them on trial, and then the sentence is carried out. It's pretty quick. There's no, like, it doesn't take weeks. There's no appeal system or anything like that. These are done fast, potentially many, many trials in a single day.
Well, okay. I mean, and so whilst they're waiting for the assizes to take place, because as you said, it's a travelling circuit, so I imagine they're not like there in straight away. They
have to wait. Yeah, it's once a year, so like they come around regularly once a year. So it's always at a particular time of year. So they don't send for them because there is a trial. They wait in prison until the judge comes round. The jail is emptied. They do all of the trials for all the criminals in that district, and then they move on to another district. And prison is not really seen as a punishment in this period, or jail. It's a means of holding prisoners who they are worried are, we would use the term flight risk or something like that, I think.
Okay.
So it's to stop prisoners from running away before their trial.
Right.
That's basically the idea of jail in this period. It's not supposed to be...
It's not about reform.
Your punishment. It's certainly not about reform. It's literally just there to keep you until you can be tried.
We know that the Northumberland, which was kept in Newcastle Castle, and the others were kept in Newgate.
Yes.
So what were those conditions like in those two prisons?
I mean, the castle keep is notoriously unpleasant. That would have been for Jane Martin, probably only just before the assizes. There was also a prison in Morpeth for Northumberland, and one in Hexham, actually, where they'd probably be kept longer term. And then she'd be brought down just before the assizes, maybe the week before the assizes or so, to be kept in Newcastle in the keep.
Okay.
It's not nice. I mean, it's one room. It's a cold vaulted chamber at the bottom of the castle keep. She would likely have been chained to the wall. The castle was quite ruinous at this period, so it seems that the water could certainly get in. It's described by the 1700s by prison reformers as being often knee-deep in water.
Oh, golly.
So the conditions were pretty unpleasant. Newgate is... We have a fairly good idea of what Newgate looked like. We've got engravings of the actual gatehouse, which is a pretty massive structure. And we know there were 10 rooms in the prison, about 14 square feet each. So these are 10 small cells, mm-hmm. With six prisoners to a room. They were also potentially chained up. We do hear of people being chained. That's kind of up to the jailer. It's a means, again, of preventing them from escaping. Newgate Prison was actually pretty notorious for not being terribly secure as a place to keep prisoners. So they were often chained to prevent them from getting out.
Do we know anything about sort of what else might have happened in prison? Because by my understanding is that you had to pay to live there and you know, things weren't given to you for free like they would be now, where it's seen as like a duty of care towards prisoners. That notion didn't exist.
That's right, yeah. So again, prison isn't there. It's not seen as something that the state provides to keep its citizens safe or to reform people who are in prison. So people were expected to pay for their own keep in prison, really. It was, if you couldn't pay, you got the bare necessities to keep you alive until your trial. But by and large, you were charged for all sorts of things. We know by the 1700s, the jailer in Newcastle Castle used to charge people sixpence to come and jeer at the prisoners. This is a way that jailers made themselves a little bit of extra money. They were not well paid. They were often criminals themselves. It's not like a highly skilled job that you pick the best person for. They were low down the social pecking order. And there are records of, for instance, a prison break from Newgate where one of the ex-jailers is locked up there, but knows how to escape because...
Of course he does.
he was the jailer.
Do we know anything else that they might have charged people for? I remember looking at, like, in the records that I saw in the Newcastle archives, they had whole lists of things of, like, money being exchanged all the time.
Yeah, there are lots of fees. So we don't know what the specific fees were in the mid-17th century, but we do have a list of the kinds of things that were paid for. So it was traditional, for example, you could pay a fee to have your chains loosed. So you would be chained up and then the jailer could charge you to unchain you.
Okay.
To make your stay slightly more comfortable. It was traditional to pay an entry fee, which included a round of drinks for people who were already there.
An entry fee?
An entry fee. So when you came into prison, it was traditional.
You had to pay.
Yeah.
What if you didn't want to pay? Be like, I don't want to go in.
Well, I guess you got extra chains piled on top of you, basically.
Okay.
So tips for the jailer were common as well. So the jailer would run errands for the prisoners if they were paid to do so. Wood for your fire, straw for your bedding, all that kind of stuff was paid for. Most of the people accused of witchcraft are not likely to have been especially wealthy.
Yeah.
So whether they would have been able to afford these kind of fees or have a much more basic existence in prison, as I say, six of them in a single 14 square foot room with kind of chains to keep them from running away, I suspect it would be on the grimmer side of prison conditions. I don't think any of them were likely to be able to afford servants to fetch
things for them. And they would have, you know, if we make the assumption that sort of the majority of witches were tended to be older as well, I can only imagine how uncomfortable and horrible it would have been for them to be held there.
Absolutely. The conditions, by modern standards, certainly are absolutely horrific, really, in prisons of this period.
Yeah.
This is an era, of course, where there's lots and lots of disease and things like that going around as well. So that would be rife in conditions like prison, I suspect. Weak immune systems, you know, people packed together in tight spaces.
This sort of leads on nicely to what else I want to talk about in terms of if, you know, is it possible that the witches were tortured? Because Jane Martin, who was convicted in Northumberland, there's testimony that says her, you know, her sister gave a confession that both of them were involved in witchcraft. Only Jane Martin was killed, so we don't really know what happened to the sister. Likely that she would have died in prison. But we don't really have any documentation of other confessions apart from this one. Is it likely that maybe confession, they did try to get confessions from people, or if, you know, were these prisoners further tortured after the Witchfinder found them guilty? Like,
so torture was technically illegal in the English legal system from really the Middle Ages onwards. Torture is not a standard feature of the English legal system. In much of Europe, they follow a kind of Roman model of law, and the Romans were big into torture. And it was considered quite normal in France or Germany, for example, and Scotland to an extent, just to, if somebody was accused of something, to torture them to try and get information out of them or a confession. That's not really the case in England. So it could be directly authorised by the king.
Like with Guy Fawkes.
With Guy Fawkes, that's probably the most famous example. We actually have the order for him to be tortured on the rack by order of James the Sixth and First to get the names of his other conspirators. So he was tortured, but that was not a normal part of what they did in trials. So it'd be very unusual to see something that they would describe as torture. So that's, you know, all of the classic horrible things that people will be familiar with from
the rack.
Witch trials on the continent. Yeah, the rack, you know, burning people with hot irons, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Would probably not go on. But there are loopholes that were used in some English witch trials.
Yeah, like Matthew Hopkins. Yes. I read about him making people walk around a lot.
Walking witches was one of his methods of getting confessions out of people. So Matthew Hopkins is, again, he's a curious case, because what he was doing is probably not, even at the time, thought of as being strictly legal. And yeah, the civil authority has broken down, really, and he's able just to call himself the Witchfinder General and go around the countryside offering to find witches for people.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that he did that maybe didn't count as torture to the people at the time might still not have gone down very well in most English courts in this period.
Okay.
It's just that he was operating out of the usual legal framework. But he used to use sleep deprivation, walking people, which is basically two big burly blokes would grab you and hold you under the arms and walk you round and round a room until you were exhausted.
Yeah.
He also was very fond of testing for witches, not by pricking with pins like in Scotland and the north, but he would dunk people in water. So he would tie their hands and feet together and dunk them into a river. And the idea was, if they floated, the water, which is the element of baptism, was rejecting them. And that showed that they were a witch. Whereas if they sank into the water, they believed that's what normal people would do.
It's a bit of a lose-lose situation happening there.
It's not great. And I mean, they were tied to ropes so they could be pulled back out again.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's still effectively waterboarding.
Waterboarding, yeah.
And if you sort of say, oh, well, we don't have a definitive answer yet, let's put them in again, it becomes very much like torture, I think. So there are elements like that in some English witch trials. But it's relatively unusual, and you can see that in the conviction rate, which is, in Europe, I think, once you're accused of being a witch, that was it. You were finished.
Yeah.
You know, you would be tortured into a confession. And normally they were torturing people to try and get names of other witches as well. So these trials spread and become quite large in on the continent. So there are some where there are 300-400 people a day being found guilty of witchcraft.
Of course, because, I mean, a lot of the imagery around, like, witch trials, especially from Europe, it's large groups of people involved in, like, a conspiracy against a town or, you know, the community. Whereas here it's slightly small, even though in Newcastle, though, surprising, it is quite a large group.
Yeah, Newcastle's unusual in that. It's one of the largest single sort of mass executions of witches in English history. It tends to be smaller scale in England. Whether that might be something to do with witch beliefs in England, that people didn't think of witches as being involved in these big covens or groups. But it might also just be a function of the fact that you're not just getting people naming names to avoid torture, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, in England, I think it's about 500 people executed for witchcraft in the whole period of the witch executions, which, as I say, compared to Germany, you get that in a single day in some places.
Yeah.
And I was reading about some of the cases in Germany. There's a case called the Pappenheimer witch trial, and they talk about things like burning their limbs with torches, hanging them from the ceiling with weights on their ankles, hoisting them into the air with their arms tied behind their back to kind of dislocate their shoulders, all sorts of things like that. And in Scotland, they use a device called the Pillywinks. So they're like a metal construction that screws shut and crushes your thumbs. And something called the boot, which is basically the same sort of thing, but it's a huge boot that crushes your bones and your feet. So people were very much routinely tortured for confessions in, as say, Scotland and Europe. They have a different legal tradition from England, really. But you would be expected in England at the assizes to be able to produce evidence of witchcraft.
Yeah, so this is, I guess, the big question is what evidence would have been presented?
That's really difficult to know. And like you say, there's not much evidence that there were confessions involved.
Yeah.
The evidence becomes very strange in witch trials. And a lot of the time, you see them accepting what they call spectral evidence in court. This is particularly famous.
Doesn't sound very real.
Well, no, I mean, by definition, I suppose it isn't. It's certainly not illusory. That would be the wrong word, because they didn't see it as being an illusion as such. But it was something that only certain people could see. The most famous example of it in English law is from a little bit later than Newcastle, in the 1690s in Massachusetts, which was still an English colony at the time, the Salem witch trials. They don't really have as much of a distinction in this period between what we would describe as circumstantial evidence and real evidence either. So if you could show that somebody was generally thought to be a witch, to be of bad character, you know, that would stand against them in court as well. So this is trial by jury in England in this period, but it's done slightly differently from nowadays. So the jury would know the accused.
Of course, if they were from Newcastle, yeah, because it's such a small place.
That's it. It's a small town. It's probably, I mean, even by 1650, it's probably only 12,000 people at most in the whole town.
Yeah.
And the jury were usually drawn from the local towns and villages. So they would pick 12 people each year who were known to be truthful and of good character. And they would form the jury. Yeah. And their job in a trial, again, you've got to remember there is no police force to search for evidence or present that in a court. So the jury were expected to do that as well. So they were expected to come to court already having investigated these crimes. And they were thought to have, you know, they would have knowledge of the people in their local district. So they might go, oh, yes, well, people have said for years that, you know, such and such is a witch. And, you know, certainly she's been seen in the company of, you know, a toad, and talking to it. And things like this would be brought up, and these might be brought as evidence against you.
I'm not sure you really stood a chance, though, if people in the community already thought, you know, they didn't like you, or they, you know, you were on the wrong side of things politically, or you, you know, were in business and people wanted you out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... You do get people acquitted of witchcraft in England, it's worth saying. I think, actually, the acquittal rate is upwards of 50%. So okay. I actually think, technically, the majority of people accused of witchcraft in this period are acquitted in court. They're found not guilty. But in this case, we don't really know what was going on, whether there was this kind of hysteria around witchcraft, which you see in Salem, or whether there is something political going on. I suspect that there is. I think the fact that it's taking place at the very end of the sort of first round, if you like, of the Civil War.
Yeah.
It does seem to me that there may well be like some political motivations there. Might be getting, you know, the women of prominent royalist families out of the way or something along those lines.
So there are various theories of maybe some of the witches of the, you know, the convicted ones, some of them passed away, maybe some were acquitted, because we know that that could have been likely.
I think that's probably the case. I think Gardner would, if lots and lots of them, you know, another 15 effectively, had died in prison, I think Gardner
would have mentioned that.
Because I think his goal in writing his book is to kind of show everyone how cruel and wicked the Newcastle Corporation are. And I think if he could have said, you know, not only did they hang 15 people for witchcraft, but they would have hanged, you know, 28, but the others all died in prison or something like that. I have a feeling he would mention that.
So, sadly, you know, 16 people were executed. Do we know what that would have been like, does it happen straight after the assizes that they're like, you're guilty now, or do you, you know, do you wait a bit?
It would be pretty soon afterwards. It's not, there's not like a long wait. It's not in death row in America. I think you'd be talking days, maybe weeks.
Because there's no appeals.
No.
Okay.
There's no system for appeals at all in the English law. It's not allowed for. So when you're found guilty by a jury, that's it. As far as people are concerned, you are guilty.
Do we know where the execution took place? Because there's a bit of debate around this.
There is. I mean, broadly, yeah. It's on the town moor.
That's a massive place.
But that's massive. So yeah, I mean, if we want to get more specific, there will be some debate. We know people process through the town. This is public. These were public executions. They went up the street known as Gallowgate, which comes out of Newgate.
Yeah.
And up on the town moor to the north.
So for people that know modern day Newcastle, Gallowgate runs, I guess, towards St. James's Park and Leeses Park. Yeah,
past St. Andrew's Church.
Yeah.
And yeah, up towards St. James's Park. There's various sites been proposed for the gallows, and most of these, I think, are based on Gardiner's book.
Mm-hmm.
Really, somewhere near the BBC building, Fenham Barracks, that kind of area, Barrack Road, what's now Leeses Park, or Castle Leeses.
Yeah.
It's that kind of area. Certainly. So in 1844, the last public execution takes place in Newcastle, and it's mentioned in the newspaper in the Newcastle Courant. It says the town moor, a little bit beyond the barracks, the site where criminals have been put to death for 600 years.
Okay.
So they're saying this is the traditional execution site. That was certainly believed to be the case in the 1840s. I'm not sure, in actual fact, I don't think there was a permanent gallows up there. Executions, despite the reputation this period's got, they weren't common enough of occasions that, you know, you would need a permanent gallows set up somewhere to be constantly hanging.
So it's not like
people.
Every month there was an execution.
Yeah, it's nothing like that. It's that, you know, there are years between executions usually. So I think they would probably be constructed for the occasion. So it might not be on the exact same site every time anyway. I think, you know, might well be in slightly different locations. But the town moor certainly was traditional. It's a big gathering place for the people of the town. And as I say, these were a public affair, a public occasion, execution.
Which makes, I guess, the rest of this conversation quite horrifying, because we have to say that they were, in fact, hung. And it's not really the kind of hanging that we might see in more recent times. It's not a quick lever that you fall through the trap door. It's a pretty horrific way.
Yeah, it was considered a horrible way to die. It was considered a very humiliating way to die. That's why it was chosen in cases of felony in England, is that it was seen as shameful to die this way. The way it was done is just you were taken up a ladder, the rope was put around your neck, and they then removed the ladder, and you were just left to hang under your own weight, basically. You would strangle. That's how you would die. And it is pretty, it's pretty horrible. As I say, it was considered kind of undignified. That was the way they would have looked at it at the time. So people's eyes bulge, your tongue sort of swells up. And actually, in the case of the Newcastle witches, one of the things Gardiner writes about, Margaret Brown goes to the gallows, and she prays to God to send a sign for the people that she is being executed unjustly.
Yeah.
So that she is innocent. And when she's hanged, it says, as soon as she drops, so there would be a little drop as the ladder is pulled away, you know, they would drop slightly under her own weight, blood gushes out of her onto the crowd, out of her mouth. And I wonder whether, like, that might be her biting her tongue, basically, like when she's there on the gallows. But certainly this is seen as being, you know, God's intervention. This is like a sign from God.
Blood from a witch, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're not meant to bleed like that.
Well, that's it, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, having just said that as well, you know, God send a sign, and then suddenly this kind of like great event. And I suppose if the blood then goes out onto some of the crowd, it's that thing of God is, he's saying, you know, her blood is on you, you know, you're guilty of having killed her.
So let's go to like why it was a public event, because I can't imagine ever wanting to see such a horrific sight. But people did go. So why couldn't have this just been you know, in the castle grounds or the jail, somewhere private, and you'd be like, yeah, we've executed them. Like, why was it seen as such a public thing?
So from 1844 onwards, that is what would happen. It would, executions, then public executions are abolished in England,
mm-hmm.
and they're typically done in the prison grounds, and the prisoners are buried in the prison grounds.
Yeah.
Earlier than that, though, being public was part of the point of an execution. It was seen as being instructive. So it was a warning to those who would break the law or disobey the law. It makes the point about the power that the state has, the king, who, of course, this is all done in the name of the king.
Yeah.
Or at least in this period, the...
Whoever was in charge.
Yes, the government, I suppose, yeah. In the name of parliament. But it makes that point about the power of the state to punish people with death. If they disobey the law. And it was thought as well that it would provide it would allow the honest citizens to see that justice had been done. So if you had a famous outlaw or criminal or something, killing them publicly is saying, you are safe, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have got rid of this horrible person, you know. And I'm certain that would be the case with witches, you know. They're saying, you know, we can keep you safe from witches. Look, here are the witches. You can see that they're dead.
Yeah.
Know, they're gone. Like, that's you safe. And yeah, the idea was that it would be a lesson to people, really. The law was very harsh. It's designed to be a deterrent. That's what they certainly believed that would be the case.
My idea of public executions only comes from watching movies where, you know, crowds are jeering the prisoners. There's, you know, it's quite an electric, angry atmosphere, lots of jeering. Is that accurate in any way?
They were notoriously rowdy occasions, public executions. The accounts we've got of these occasions by the 1700s and 1800s, a lot of the more educated people in society are starting to view these occasions as being not great for public morals.
Yeah.
They're starting to doubt whether, you know, the public gets any kind of beneficial effect from watching people be executed. Instead, they're starting to think, you know, this is just exercising people's bloodlust, their desire to see somebody else hurt or killed.
Mm-hmm.
People sold songs at them. These are often called broadsides or murder ballads sometimes.
Murder ballads, wow.
Yeah. People would sell souvenirs, food, you'd have entertainers there. It was a real, you know, kind of almost carnival.
It just makes me feel even worse for the witches, because, I mean, how long did people hang there for? Like, were they kept a long time, or was it quite a quick death and they'd be like, okay?
You die probably within, I think, does it take about 10 minutes, I think, somebody, I've been told.
That's still too long.
It would take 10 minutes. Well, yeah, an horrible amount of time. It's one reason in this period, people from the upper social classes, the higher social classes, were usually beheaded rather than hanged. And that was seen as being a nicer punishment. It's quicker, you know.
Yeah.
One blow of the axe, in theory, if you had a good executioner.
The king was beheaded.
He certainly was, yeah. And that was fairly quick. And it allows for a more dignified death. So you kind of come out, you confess your crimes, you bow your head down. And
it's over pretty quick.
Yeah, and you can be seen to be sort of facing your death mm-hmm. bravely. Whereas with hanging, it's, you're kind of dangling there for a while. You're not left up there after that. You'd be taken down and buried. And sure enough, one of the best records we've got of these witch trials is the St. Andrew's Parish Register, which records the burial of Matthew Bulmer, Elizabeth Anderson, Jane Hunter, Mary Potts, Alice Hume, Eleanor Rogerson, Margaret and Muffet, Margaret Madison, Elizabeth Brown, Margaret Brown, Jane Copeland, Anne Watson, Eleanor Henderson, Elizabeth Dobson, Catherine Coulter, and Jane Martin for witchcraft.
It's incredibly upsetting to know that this happened in Newcastle, in this city, especially that also there's very little to acknowledge that this happened. I know the Newcastle Castle are working on a memorial, but it's not a well-known story at all. And, you know, if we put ourselves back in that place with, you know, the Witchfinder trial, and then the assizes, and then this public execution, which was such a huge, you know, display, and these poor innocent people executed. It's easy to think that maybe everybody in the city felt like this. There was this huge witch craze. Everybody wanted to kill the witches, but maybe that's not true.
Well, I mean, certainly it's worth remembering the only reason we really know anything about this at all, this would barely be a footnote in the history books if it wasn't for Ralph Gardner.
Yeah.
Who is definitely not in favour of the witch trials. He is pretty clear that he believes that the Witchfinder was a fraud. Mm-hmm. In fact, he has this story that the Witchfinder was eventually arrested himself,
yeah,
admitted to being a fraud, and was executed. So Gardner himself is a famous figure from that time who is openly and publicly very sceptical about witch trials. It is worth remembering that in all of these kind of events, there are these people who stand up to be counted and, you know, put their foot down, successfully or otherwise.
And in fact, 65 years after this happened, witchcraft would no longer be a crime. So in that 65 years, you know, the voices of good rather won out.
It's remarkable how quickly the sort of craze fades, really. Mm-hmm. By 1715, the Witchcraft Act in 1715 effectively abolishes witchcraft as a crime. So you could no longer then be accused of being a witch. It's remarkable how quickly it goes from being something which is deeply and sincerely, in many cases, believed in by people. Not just the prosecutors. I mean, I suspect in some of these cases, some of the people themselves who were accused may have believed that they were practicing magical arts or had kind of powers. So deeply, sincerely believed in by a lot of people, and then it just kind of falls out of favour.
As always, this has been equally fascinating and upsetting. thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk us through this. And as always, if you're interested to know more about the history of Newcastle, highly recommend going to Newcastle Castle. Take your friends, take your family. David and the team are just great at conveying the history of the city and, you know, from Roman times right up to now.
Yeah, it's got a massive history, long history to it. So Roman fort, Norman castle, medieval fortress, and right the way through the civil wars and into the modern day. If you come now, you get a year's ticket.
Wow.
So we're now doing yearly tickets. So if you buy your ticket, you get in for 1 year.
Well, thank you again for coming by and talking to us again.
Brilliant.
You've been listening to the Newcastle Witches podcast by Candle and Bell. We'll be back again soon with a new episode called A Burial on Hallowed Ground. In the meantime, you can find us on social media under the Newcastle Witches podcast.